Last night we talked quite a bit about the Buddha, and one of the points that we tried to make last night was that the Buddha's a human being, and I think sometimes there's a tendency to deify the Buddha and to think of the Buddha as a god, particularly when you have like 8-foot tall statues and stuff, but it's really so much of the story of the Buddha is the story of a human being, and we really need to remember that. The Buddha's journey was a human journey, and like any human journey, he made a lot of mistakes until he became fully awakened, of course. If you think about the Buddha's journey, we think about somebody who lived for almost 30 years as somebody who was wealthy, who had a lot of sense pleasures, a lot of material things, came from a very wealthy and renowned family, and decided to pursue a spiritual life. And the spiritual practices of his day were largely ascetic practices, so he undertook ascetic practices and practiced in a way in which he experienced great deprivation and great renunciation of all sense experiences, because they believed that that was the way to happiness. And after 6 years, he realized he was on the wrong track. He was on the wrong track. Just read a little bit about what he said about that. He said, "Whatever Brahmins or contemplatives in the past have felt painful, racking, piercing feelings due to their striving, this is the utmost. None have been greater than this. But with this racking practice of austerities, I haven't attained any superior human state, any distinction in knowledge or vision." 6 years. I complain after one bad sitting. It's like one bad sitting. That's 6 years. 6 years. And Mara always came and visited the Buddha, and the Buddha often talked about the fact that Mara coming was going to be part of the practice. He said this to the monks. He said, "Monks, Mara is continually, ceaselessly hovering around you, thinking, perhaps I'll get an opportunity by means of the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body. Perhaps I'll get an opportunity by means of the intellect. Thus, monks, you should dwell with the doors to your senses well guarded." Because Mara is always looking for a way in, a sound that you don't like, or a sound that you want to listen to, a taste, a thought, a bodily sensation. Right? So we have to be on the lookout for Mara. And in one of his conversations with Mara, and I love this because he's kind of saying, there you are, Mara, and this is what you're about. And he identifies Mara's means of giving out unskillfulness, Mara's means of infusing us with unskillfulness, the dangers of Mara. Sometimes called the armies of Mara. He says to Mara, "Sensual passions are your first army." See if any of these ring true. "Sensual passions are your first army. Your second is called discontent. Your third is hunger and thirst. Your fourth is called craving. Fifth is sloth and drowsiness. Sixth is called terror. Your seventh is uncertainty. Hypocrisy and stubbornness, your eighth. Gains offering fame and status wrongly gained, and whoever would praise self and disparage others. That, Mara, is your army, the Dark One's commando force." So I like how he labels there. So the point here that I want to make is, when we think about this practice, when we think about doing what we're doing here, it's hard. It's hard. This is not an easy practice. It's hard. The Buddha talked about the four types of beings that there are, and it was one of the ways he categorized the way we could be. And he says, the first type of being is the being that goes along with the flow, kind of goes along with the culture, and looks for happiness and sense experience, and relates to the world with desire and aversion. And then the second type of person is the type of person who says, I'm not going to look for happiness and sense pleasure. I'm going to seek to give up desire and aversion to the best of my ability and live with love and kindness. You know, I'm going to go against the flow. I'm going to go against the stream. He says the first, you know, doing what the first kind of being does, person does, is pretty easy. It's easy to go along with the flow. He said going against the flow is very difficult, and it leads to, at the beginning, oftentimes many tears. And who is the individual who goes with the flow? There is the case where an individual indulges in sensual passions and does unskillful things. This is called the individual who goes with the flow. Who is the individual who goes against the flow? There is the case where an individual doesn't indulge in sensual passions and doesn't do unskillful things, even though it may be with pain, even though it may be with sorrow, even though he may be crying, his face in tears. He lives the holy life that is perfect and pure. This is called the individual who goes against the flow. So that could kind of describe some of us here today, right? You know, he may be crying, his face in tears. But then we get to the point where we become the individual who stands fast, who we just keep staying with it, we keep staying with it, we keep staying with it, and we move beyond the tears. And sometimes there's still tears, but we begin to really know the happiness of the path, and then finally the individual who crosses over to true happiness. So, you know, this is a good description of the way the path can unfold for us, but there is, pretty much by definition, going to be challenged. It is going to be hard. There are going to be tears. Remember, Ajahn Chah used to say, you know, if you haven't cried on the meditation cushion, you haven't really meditated, you know? And I had a friend who was very upset because he never cried on the meditation cushion. He was always like, so upset. I never even cried. I'm not a real meditator. So it's good to acknowledge, you know, it's good to acknowledge that this is the way it is. This is the truth. It's hard. It's hard sometimes. It's difficult. It's a challenge. There are going to be tears when we go against the flow. You know, it's like if you decided you wanted to run the marathon, you know, or become a marathoner, you would understand that there was going to be some sweat and toil and some difficulty that was going to go into that. You wouldn't say, you know, I think I'll run the marathon because it's going to be really easy and I just need something easy to do. You know, but that's sometimes the way we approach meditation, because we think of the benefits and what happens when we, you know, we think of the results. You know, we think of the results, but to get to that point of results, sometimes there's going to be tears. It's going to be a challenge. You know, if you wanted to get a PhD, you know, we have a few PhDs here. You know that it's a lot of work is going to go into it. It's not going to be easy, but there's going to be a payoff. There's going to be a payoff. And that's what we have to acknowledge with this practice. You know, sometimes it's going to be difficult. It's going to be challenging. Oftentimes the first few days on retreat are challenging. Sometimes the second part of the retreat is challenging. Sometimes the third part of the retreat is challenging. The practice can be challenging. This is part of the path. You know, this is kind of what we sign up for. We always kind of kid around and say, oh, we don't put it in the brochures. You know, we don't put it into the course description. Maybe we should. You know, maybe we should put it in the course description. Now, this is the way that it is. It's good to acknowledge it. It's good to accept that this is the way that it is. That it's hard sometimes, it's difficult sometimes. You know, we fight that. We don't want it to be difficult. We don't want it to be challenging. But there's really no getting around it. At some point, you know, and I'm sure there's some people saying, oh, it's been really easy for me so far. I'm really missing out here. You know, as my uncle would say, you'll get yours. You know, you know, it's hard and it's challenging because we're building something true. You know, we're not building some flimsy thing here. We're building something true. We're building something strong. We're building something reliable, something that's durable. You know, we're building a strong mind. You know, we're not building a flimsy mind. We're developing a strong mind. You know, we're developing a mind that can lead us to true happiness. It requires a noble effort. Goethe said it, a noble effort, when we make a noble effort, it's as difficult as it is rare. It's a rare thing to make a noble effort. What we're doing here is an extremely rare thing. Most people are going with the flow, indulging in all those Sunday night TV shows that we all love. We're going against the flow here. It's as difficult as it is rare. There's going to be blood and sweat, tears. I don't want to see just tears on the cushion. I want to see blood. I want to see sweat on those cushions. We can't make a slapdash effort. A slapdash effort leads to a slapdash mind. We make a half-assed effort, the mind is going to be half-assed. It's not going to stand up. Reminds me of a little story when I was in junior high, and you're in junior high, you're starting to kind of get your mojo going, your identity. So this was in the 60s, so I wanted to, usually my mother would buy my clothes, but I want to get my own clothes, So parents gave me a little bit of money. Part of the problem was I think I went to Corvettes or something, it's like, did they sell clothes at Corvettes? It was like a really kind of a cheap club, but I thought I had a groovy pair of pants. I thought these were the grooviest, probably some kind of a bell-bottom, and I was really proud, Wore them once, tore right down the seam, And my father offered me one of those life lessons. He said, only get what you pay for. I can hear it ringing in my ears. Only get what you pay for. It's kind of like that with the practice. If we want the practice to hold up, if we want the mind to hold up, we've got to pay the price. We've got to pay the price. We've got to put in the effort. Bringing about change is not easy. It's not an easy thing. This is why we're here, to bring about change. We're changing from a life ruled by desire and aversion, that life going with the flow, to a life in which we are seeking to live with love, with kindness, with stillness, with happiness, greater happiness. We're trying to find a life of greater happiness. Now, really what we're changing is the mind. What we're learning to change is the mind. It's a lot easier, I think Thoreau said, to change your clothes than to change your mind. Or he said, don't bother to change your clothes, change your mind. That's what's really important. But it's not easy to change the mind. And we need to recognize this. We need to remember this. Why is this so hard? This is so difficult. Well, the short answer to that is, duh. Changing the mind is going to be difficult. We're changing a lifetime of karma. And we need to understand that and accept that. And it's one of the ways that the Buddha characterized karma is like a very fast river, a very fast moving river. That's our conditioning. So, we're in that fast river of mental qualities that we have been continuing to develop, continuing to fuel, continuing to feed all of our lives, aversion, desire, delusion, this fast river. What we're trying to do is slow the river down and climb out, but sometimes it's going really fast and it's hard to even slow it down. The concentration is really about slowing the river down so that we can grab onto a branch, and get up onto the shore. But sometimes that river is moving really fast. And we can just hold on. It's like one of those movies when they're in the, caught in the rapids. And you're just trying to get a little bit of air sometimes. We have to understand that we have limitations based on our karma. And accept that. Now, we can get beyond those limitations, but it's going to require a lot of hard work. So we have to acknowledge and accept that it's going to be hard for us at times. Our limitations, really, what they amount to is, our untrained minds. It's like somebody who wants to run the marathon and has never trained before. Well, that's going to be a limitation. You're going to have to put in a lot of work. And most of us are further along than that, but we still have work to do. It's tougher to change the mind than it is to change the body. It's also very important in you know, Dharma talks are largely about right view, you know, so we know how to approach our practice, and we have to bring what we hear into the Dharma talk into practice. We have to remember these things that we hear the Buddha say, and remember them when we're practicing. So remember these things when you're practicing. One of the things that's really important to remember is that a lot of the work that happens in the darkness. You know, a lot of what's happening when we're going through these difficult periods is very beneficial work. You know, something is happening when you're struggling. Something is happening when you are experiencing what you're experiencing. You know, so it's important to remember that. You know, and I always say, you know, this is a learning experience. This is part of the process. It's a learning experience. And if we think of the great metaphor for awakening in this tradition, it's the metaphor of the lotus, you know, that really grows and matures in the mud under the water. You know, and then finally comes up, you know, we just see the beautiful flower on the surface of the water. But all the work has been done in the mud underneath. So, you know, you're struggling. It's like, just think, you know, I'm just that lotus. I'm growing, I'm maturing, I'm developing what I need to develop so that I can rise above. Now, a lot of times in concentration, I've talked about this before, you know, we're doing, you know, it seems like, oh, I've got hindrances and, you know, there's restlessness, there's dullness, I don't have any concentration. You're really developing concentration. You know, as long as you're making a wholehearted effort to work with the hindrances and doing the best that you can to be mindful of the breath and the body, concentration is developing. You know, in many ways, it's developing, you know, real strength. You know, we develop strength by moving through resistance, moving through it skillfully. And sometimes people will say, you know, they'll come into interviews and I have no, they're like, I have no concentration. The concentration just isn't that, you know, and it's like, I've really been struggling with the hindrances, you know, but we just don't realize sometimes. So when I'm struggling with the hindrances, you know, I'll remind myself, you know, you're still developing concentration, you're developing good qualities, you're developing effort, you're developing determination. Remember that. You know, at the end of this, you know, the classic at the end of the sitting, oh, that sucked. Oh, messed that one up. Oh, D on that one, F on that one, C minus, you know. Watch what your mind is doing at the end of the sitting. It's really interesting. I mean, you got to laugh. At this point, I just laugh. It's like, God, that is so funny, mind. I can't believe you threw that out there. It's hysterical. That's hysterical. It's just Mara. It's important to reflect on our purpose. We've been talking a lot about purpose, but it's important. You know, we're in the midst of things, and I've been talking about, you know, you're in the midst of things, and it seems really challenging, it seems like things aren't really going so well, and, you know, and sometimes when you're in the midst of things, it's hard to remember to take a step back. And again, as I said last night, that's often a good time to come in for an interview, which a lot of people have done very skillfully, I thought. You know, but when we're in the midst of things, you know, it's really important to take a step back. And one of the things that we can reflect on is, you know, what's our purpose? You know, why am I doing this? You know, well, we could very simply, you know, you have to kind of find your own way into that and your own way of understanding that. You know, but it ultimately comes down to our purpose is to find a greater happiness in life. You know, that this is why we're here. You know, that what we're doing may be hard, but it's in the service of something great. Finding a greater happiness. So we really need to kind of remember that. You know, again, this is the skillful fabrication. You know, I'm really struggling, but, you know, this struggle is all part of the process of moving towards a greater happiness. You know, if I already had a greater happiness, I wouldn't need to be doing this. This is why I'm doing this, because there is struggle in the mind, because the mind is untrained, because there is desire and aversion in the mind. This is why I'm doing this, to change. So I've got to deal with what I've got to change. You know, this is a noble effort. Most people will never do that. Most people will never look at their pain and their suffering. Most people will never say, you know, I think I'll take a week, go really into silence so I can look at all my desire and aversion. It's going to be a great week. Oh, fantastic. You know? Remember that. Remember what your purpose is. Remember that you're fulfilling your purpose in doing what you're doing. You know, it's not, you know, we didn't come here so that it could be easy necessarily. You know, I mean, we're trying to cultivate beautiful states and a sense of ease and a sense of well-being. That's part of what we're learning to do. Yeah, but we came here to find a greater happiness. You know, so, you know, and again, you know, we're talking about, you know, these are some things to think about, but these are some things to remember. You know, remember that you're here. What you're doing is extraordinary, you know. You're doing really well. I mean, you're doing really well just by being here. You're doing really well by practicing. I mean, you're all practicing so earnestly. It's just that it's not always that easy, you know. Because it's hard doesn't mean you're not doing really well. It doesn't mean that you're not doing phenomenally. It's just hard. It's just hard sometimes. Or as Tan Jeff once said, one of the most deepest and profound statements he ever said. He said, "The Buddha never said it was going to be easy." You know, you can look it up. A lot of what we're talking about here is perception, right? You know, the aggregate of perception. You know, perception drives what our minds are like. You know, perception drives our thinking, perception drives our self-image, our story, our narrative. You know, and for the most part, for most of us, perception drives suffering because it's rooted in desire and aversion. So perception, you know, we talk about this aggregate of perception that, you know, really is the linchpin that drives suffering. Yeah. And you know, we have these self-perceptions that are, you know, just the causes and the root of so much suffering for us. And we all have kind of different things, but these self-perceptions that drive suffering. You know, I'm a bad student. I'm a poor meditator. I'm an inferior person. You know? I mean, think about the kinds of self-perceptions that you've, you know, and of course they're habitual. You know, the self-perceptions that you have about yourself as a meditator will be the same kinds of perceptions that you have about yourself in other areas. You know, but think about the kinds of self-perceptions that you've had today about yourself. You know? I mean, the perceptions that arose habitually, which are the ones that are going to arise, obviously, until we begin to start changing them, you know, they're going to be driven, for the most part, by aversion or desire. So the self-perceptions oftentimes are driven by a lot of self-aversion, negative self-image. So kind of pay attention to that, see that. You know, what kind of self-perceptions are arising? You can't do that much about their arising. You really can't do anything about their arising, but are you feeling them? Because that's what really gives rise to the suffering, right? I mean, if you think about it, you know, all the things that were challenging really weren't what was so difficult. What was difficult was what was arising out of the self-perception that you had based on what was difficult. So look at those self-images and start to see them for what they are, just perceptions. They're empty. You know, they're just habitual ways of looking at things and labeling things. In this case, looking at yourself and labeling yourself. So look at those self-perceptions and begin to start to change them. We just don't let go of perception. First, we have to cultivate skillful perceptions. Tan Jeff talks about this, that we construct the path using the aggregates so that we can then let go of the aggregates, because we're not going to let go of clinging to perception. So we have to develop some good perceptions to hold on to replace the unskillful ones. So what we want to do is start cultivating skillful perceptions. So I'll give you one that you might want to cultivate. You know, begin to think about cultivating the perception of yourself as a warrior. Because this is really what we need to be on these retreats. We need to be warriors, spiritual warriors. You know, when I first started in Buddhism, there really weren't many books written by Theravada teachers, insight meditation teachers. So most of the books I read were Trungpa Rinpoche and stuff like that. And, you know, some students here of Trungpa's and in our group over the years. And, you know, and he talked about the spiritual warrior. You know, that really spoke to me. You know, we need to be warriors in this practice. So begin to start to think about yourself. Develop that perception. I mean, you can develop that perception just as easily, you know, as the perception of I'm a stinky meditator. You know? So you can, after the retreat, you can write a book, you know, The Adventures of the Stinky Meditator or The Adventures of the Warrior in Insight Meditation. My Time at Garrison in 2012-13. You know, the warrior, you know, we're going to battle. You know, the metaphors are a little funny, but, you know, the Buddha was a warrior. He came from a warrior class. You know, we're going to battle. You know, it's like we're going against the stream. You know, you have to be a warrior to go against the stream. Think about those categories. We need to be strong. We need to persevere. We need to be strong to go against the stream. We need to persevere to stand fast, to get to the other shore. So really, you know, we're talking about a skillful perception, you know, which means fabricating, remembering. You know, I'm a skillful warrior. I'm a skillful warrior. I'm a spiritual warrior. You know, we have this capacity within us, this capacity of inner strength, this capacity of courage, you know, this capacity to be a warrior. We just don't look at ourselves that way. Kind of going back to the Wizard of Oz, it's like the Cowardly Lion, you know. He just needed that medal. You know, it's like once he got the medal, he was like, you know, the scarecrow just needed the diploma. You know, I think maybe the next retreat we'll have everybody come up and I'll give you a medal, spiritual warrior. You know. So the warrior stronghold. You know, the Thais talk about this. The warrior stronghold is the breath. You know, this is your stronghold. This is your refuge. This is the safe home. This is your fortress, your mainstay. You know, it's an internal fortress, an internal stronghold that's easeful, that's pleasurable, that gives us shelter and protection, and that's strong. It's strong. It's this place of inner strength. That's one way to think about the breath and equanimity is as inner strength. You know, so we learn to come from this place of inner strength. We come from the breath, from equanimity. We relate to the challenge and the difficulty from this place. This is why I always say it's difficult, you know, and you have to remember this. Go to the breath. Find your ground. It's like the Buddha over my shoulder here. You know, Mara attacked him with all of those armies, and, you know, he was strong. He didn't move. He kept his spot. You know, that was because, why? Because he was practicing breath meditation. He had equanimity. You know, that only came because he practiced. Followed the steps. Had a little trouble with 2A, but no. So this is our inner refuge, our inner strength. You know, and we've been establishing this stronghold. It's not like, well, I better start establishing it. I mean, most of you have been establishing it for years. You know? And this is what we're doing here. We just don't realize that to sometimes that you have that warrior stronghold. You know, you got to remember it. I'm going to get those medals, I think. I think we really need to think about that. So use that stronghold. You know? I mean, sometimes I know for myself, it's, you know, you've been developing all these skills. Time to go into battle. You know, time to go do the work. You know? So when it's difficult, go to your stronghold. Go to your mainstay, your place of strength, your place of protection. Acknowledge that you have it. And this is where confidence comes from, self-confidence. When you have that, you know, okay, I can hold up under no matter what happens here. I'm going to be okay because I can find this refuge within. I can relate to my experience from the heart. The warrior has the ability to attend to what's difficult, you know, to attend to what's difficult, you know, difficult feelings, unpleasant feelings in the body or in the mind. the difficult thinking, the difficult stories that come up, right? People talked about the difficult stories, regrets about the past, things that happened in the past, worries about the future, self-recrimination, self-doubt, anxiety, despair. You know, this is when you need to be a warrior. This is what a warrior can deal with, these difficulties, the difficult emotions that arise. These things happen. We reside in our stronghold. And we recognize, okay, things are unpleasant. The experience is unpleasant, and I can be with the unpleasant. You know, the unpleasant can be there, and I can reside in the stronghold that's easeful and pleasurable. Bring it on. You know, the warrior doesn't add that second arrow. Oh, I don't like it, it's unpleasant. Or he adds it and sees that he adds it and pulls it out. You know, we don't add on that aversion to the unpleasant. You know, it's like, okay, I can be with what's unpleasant. I can be, we talked about this a lot today in a lot of the interviews. All right, things are challenging, and you know, and I could see that warrior strength that you all have. That, all right, it's difficult, but you know what? I'm up to it. You know, I can be with this. I'm not going to get thrown off my spot. You know, the warrior sees when she's at odds with what's difficult. You know, a lot of times difficulty arises, we're at odds with it. Right? We try to get rid of it. You know, the warrior, I don't need to get rid of it. It can be there. The warrior doesn't try to escape, doesn't try to push it away. You know, we see when there's non-acceptance, and we just accept this is the way things are. We recognize, okay, it's difficult. This is challenging. There's always going to be things that are difficult. This is the way it is in life. Sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes it's challenging. Sometimes it's hard. We ground. We incline to that inner strength, that quality of equanimity. And we have acceptance. This is the way things are. And this is how you develop acceptance in the midst of what's challenging. This is what he's doing. Okay, it's difficult, but that's the way things are. Mara's gonna be there. He doesn't give up easily. You know, but that's the way it is sometimes. I can ground, I can find my ground, my safe haven, my stronghold. I can incline to this quality of inner strength and accept, okay, this is the way it is. Yeah. One indication that sometimes we're at odds with what's happening is we're trying to make things happen. We're trying to make things happen. I don't feel ease. I gotta make ease happen. Which, you know, that's very paradoxical, right? I gotta make ease happen. We were talking in some of the interviews today about, you know, just receiving your experience, not trying to create your experience, not trying to create, you know, develop your strength and just let the retreat come to you. Sometimes they talk about great athletes, just let the game come to them. Just receive your experience. You know, receive your experience with equanimity, with love, with compassion, and go from there. You know, your experience is going to teach you what you need to learn. We don't need to fight our experience. Be open to it. Receive it. You have the ability to do that. We're kind of fighting it. I want to create an experience, right? Well, this is the way it is. Can I open up to it and just receive it? Let it come to me. Reminds me of, we're talking about this, how hard it is, the practice, reminds me of that story of the monk who'd been meditating for 20 years and was pretty much convinced that he hadn't really gotten very far in 20 years and hadn't really developed good concentration in 20 years of practice, even though he had sat a lot, and kind of went into despair and decided, you know what, I've been practicing for 20 years, I haven't really developed good concentration, I'm going to kill myself. Some of you might have known. So he said, you know what? What's the point? So he got some poison, you know. It's kind of like you go into the dining room, you get the coffee, the decaf, and the poison, you know. So he got the poison, put it down, kind of looked at it. You know, maybe I'll have one more sit before I go. One more sit for all time's sake, right? So he sat, you know, and he got into his posture, you know, and he was sitting there and kind of looked over at the poison every once in a while. You know, and as he looked at it, he said, this is ridiculous. Why am I going to kill myself? You know, that's kind of a little bit of an overreaction. And you know what? So what? Who cares? You know, it'd be great if I could get some concentration, but you know what? It's not that big of a deal. Shortly thereafter, of course, he got concentration. Jhana. So, you know, we need to bring kind of a light touch to things, particularly when it's difficult. You know, as we like to say, you know, a sign of good health is a sense of humor. A sign of good health is a sense of humor. This year, this isn't the funny part of the story, but this year I have my 40th high school reunion. For 40 years since I graduated high school, can you believe that? I was one of those rare people who graduated when I was 5, so. You know, and when I was in high school, I was like, you know, I laughed a lot, you know, and I remember my friend Jimmy Kelleher wrote on my yearbook, you know, known you since 7th grade, always a joker. You know, and I used to write this column in the school newspaper, it was like a comedy column, and you know, it was hysterical, you know, I have to admit, you know. And the last column I wrote, the very end of my senior year, it was like the last issue. I made a pronouncement. I said, you know what? I'm going out there into the real world. No more humor. I'm giving up all humor. You know, the title of it was A Farewell to Arms. I said, you know, the world is difficult. The world is challenging. I'm giving up all humor. And I pretty much did. You know, I pretty much did. I mean, I went into, you know, being very serious and went into addiction and went into despair. You know, and then when I was in my mid-30s, I tried, you know, I was really at a bottom. I talked about my story quite a bit, you know, and was just in tremendous despair and depression. And, you know, cleaned up my act, got myself sober, started practicing the Dharma, you know. And, you know, shortly after I started taking these moves in support of saving my life and having a good life, you know, I remember just sitting around talking to people, and, you know, I was talking. And I noticed people were laughing. And I realized, oh, I'm funny. You know? It was like, and then I start, you know, it's like I hadn't laughed in years. I hadn't laughed in years. You know, all that time when I was in such pain, you know, there was no laughter there. You know, there was the mind that was sick. Once I started to heal, the laughter started to come, and I started to laugh. You know, it's one of the great joys of life, laughter. It's a sign of good health. And my father died about 20 years ago, and, you know, we had a tough relationship, but, you know, the last number of years we kind of mended our ways to some extent, and, you know, when he died, I had 5 years of practice under my belt, so 4 or 5 years of practice under my belt, so I was able to kind of sit with him and talk, and a day or two before he died, he said, you know, and he had a tough life, you know, and didn't really live very well, but, you know, he said, I'm ready to go. You know, he said, you know, it was okay, you know, I had some laughs. I had some good laughs. And that was the thing he remembered about what was good about life, you know, that he had some laughs. There was some laughter. There was some joy. Such an important part of life. So, you know, you've got to laugh. I mean, some of the stuff that happens here, you got to laugh, right? I mean, you've got to laugh. And what else are you going to do? You know, I was coming down the stairs before to go to the meal, the evening meal, and I was a little late, and I came down the stairs, and I'm like, I don't hear anything coming from the dining room. Is this the right time for the meal? I don't hear anything at all. And I was like, oh, it's a silent retreat. You know, it's like, I had to laugh. You know, it's like, I'm waiting to hear voices. It's like, are they in there? Oh yeah, they're in silence. So I think, you know, we talk about remembering, you know, so remembering your purpose, remembering to stay with the meditation object, remembering the instructions, remembering to put aside all greed and distress with reference to the world, and number 5, remember to laugh. Remember that. You know, the Buddha and Mara, I mean, the Buddha and the monks, you know, they laughed a lot. They were not a grim bunch. I mean, I always love the interchanges between the Buddha and Ananda. It always reminds me of, this is dating me, I guess. Some of you may not be able to identify here, but it always reminded me of Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon. You know how Johnny Carson would read something about pumpkins, you know, and he'd read this thing about, and Ed McMahon would go, he'd take the paper, you know, this is great. This says everything you could possibly want to know about pumpkins. And Johnny Carson would go, wrong-o, Budweiser breath, you know, and it's like, you know, Ananda would say something like, you know, dependent origination, you know, I got it, it's an easy teaching. And the Buddha would say, no, don't say that, Ananda. You know, it would always go on like that between the two of them. There's a lot of joy and a lot of laughter in the practice. You know, I always say to people, you know, who are newer or thinking, I say, you know, we take, you know, our group is a serious group. We practice hard. We have a lot of laughs, too. T.S. Eliot, we talked about this quote a couple of years ago, I think, on this retreat. You know, he said, teach us to care and not to care. And I think that's a really nice way to hold our practice and our lives. You know, and really what it's speaking to is our tendency towards over-seriousness. You know, so really watch that tendency for over-seriousness. See the suffering in it. It's so painful. So painful. And we have to watch when it's hard. We really have to watch self-judgment, right? You know, we really have to watch our self-judgment. You know, and it's really hard because when things are difficult, we're so inclined. That's the inclination of our awareness, right, to self-judgment. In some ways, it's our cultural karma or our New York City karma. You know, it's been the inclination of our awareness for most of our lives to be hard on ourselves. You know, it's like these voices in the mind. Listen to those voices in the mind of self-judgment. And one thing you might want to start questioning, whose voice is that? Is it Mara? Is it Dad? Is Dad Mara? No. You know, I mean, you know, because what you see, it's, you know, it's not usually your voice. It's some other voice or, you know, some mixture of some voices, you know, a parent, a teacher, something like that. That's when you really you can see into the not-self nature of the self-judgment, when you see that it's just a conditioned voice in the mind. And see the self-judgment, and as we talked about last night, remember your goodness. You know, remember your goodness. And as you start to be able to recognize your goodness, you know, then you really begin to start to love yourself. You know? You start to love yourself. You know, the skillful warrior, you know, loves him and herself and loves others. And that's exemplified in the effort. You know, the effort that the skillful warrior makes is a skillful effort. I mean, it's a strong effort. It's a great effort. But what's also important about the effort is the quality of the effort. You know, it's not a pushing or an aversive effort. It's a heartful effort. It's a wholehearted effort. This is the kind of effort that we want to make. And one of the things about the skillful warrior is that she knows when to back off. It's like, you know, we think a warrior, I've got to go in and deal with it. You know, it's like, well, maybe I need to back off a little bit. Maybe I need not to go. Maybe this isn't wise to go to this sitting, or maybe I don't need to work with this thing that's arising. A skillful warrior doesn't want to get her butt kicked in battle. You know, you want to go into battle when you're ready to go into battle. So you know when to back off. You know, and we, as skillful warriors, we put our heart into it. We put our heart into the practice. Now, sometimes that seems like a very, you know, mystical thing. How do I do that? I mean, I always had that question. I put my heart into it. How do I do that? How do I do that? You know, it's not mysterious. It's not mysterious. It's very pragmatic. The first thing you have to do to put your heart into your experience, into what you're doing, into your action, into your practice, into your meditation, is get out of the head. I mean, the head is the place of aversion, self-aversion, judgment, frustration, despair. I can't do it. I've got to get away from this. We talked about this last night. So out of the head and into the body. You can think about it this way. Practice with the body. Practice with the body. Stay in the body. A friend of mine, meditation teacher George Mumford, has worked a lot with athletes. And years ago, he developed a relationship with Phil Jackson, who at the time was the coach of the Chicago Bulls. And you know, the Bulls had a lot of talent. They had Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and all these guys, but they could never beat the Detroit Pistons. problem was, the Detroit Pistons had these big, rough, tough guys, Bill Laimbeer and these, you know, Dennis Rodman and all these guys, and they used to beat up on the Chicago Bulls. And the Bulls would get angry and get out of their game. They'd get into their head and they'd go into the anger, even though they were much more talented than the Pistons. So what George taught them to do was to notice when they were, be mindful. You know, he taught them to meditate. They'd meditate before each game. They learned, some of them really became good meditators. And what he taught them to do is notice when anger arises, go to the breath, go into the body, put it aside. And play in the body, be in the body, be in the body. Allow the wisdom of your body, allow your talent to take over. You know, and that made all the difference. How many world championships did they win? There's actually a very good book about it called Sacred Hoops, written by Phil Jackson. George used to say that Michael Jordan was the only one who really didn't need the meditation. He was totally in his body, except when he was on the foul line sometimes. So, you know, we often think, you know, because we tend to be academic or intellectual, that this is an academic practice, but it's really a body practice. I mean, this is really a body practice. It's more like dancing. Yeah, it's more like dancing. You know, we want to be in the body. We want to practice from the body, just like those players wanted to play the game in the body. Think about this, you know. I mean, through fabrication, think about this. Let me practice in the body. Let me be in the body. Let me practice in the body. Let me do my walking meditation in the body. Let me be in the body. Let me sit in meditation in the body. When you get into the body, then you can get into the heart. You can practice from the heart. Let me practice from the body. Let me practice from the heart. Notice when you're thinking about the practice. In other words, in an unskillful way, which is, you know, probably going to be a lot of the ways that you're thinking about it or trying to figure out what you should do. What should I do? Should I do this? Should I do that? Bring it into the body. Your bodily wisdom knows exactly what you need to do. This is a body practice. You know, it's that one who knows inside in the body. The body knows exactly how to breathe. Exactly. The fabrication you use, even in following the steps, is really in the service of allowing the body to guide you, allowing the heart to guide you. That's why questions are better than, let me breathe this way. It's like, what's the most skillful way to breathe? Body. Let the body answer. The body knows exactly how to breathe skillfully. How are you going to figure that out? You know? The body knows how to breathe. The heart knows how to be. So we want to be in the body, we want to be in the heart, and relate from there. Relate from there. You know, as we come into the body, you know, the effort becomes joyful. You know, so the skillful warrior makes great effort, but it's joyful. You know, the skillful warrior doesn't practice grouchily. It's joyful, the effort. You know, we're in the heart, and the effort becomes joyful. You know, we have to remind ourselves that, you know, we have this goodness, and this practice is such a blessing. Remind ourselves of what we're doing, which is such a blessing, and is such an example of our own goodness. You know, so, you know, remember, you know, particularly when it's hard, when it's difficult. You know. I mean, you have to find your own way to understand and your own way to relate to what you're doing, but, you know, just recognize, you know, it's hard. It's hard. This is hard. This is difficult. It's a challenge. But, you know, you can think this way maybe, you know, at the end of the day or when you take and take a step back to reflect, you know, it's hard. It's difficult, but I'm putting in a good effort. I'm putting in a good effort. I'm putting my heart into it. I mean, what else can we do? We can put in a good effort. We can put our heart into it. It's hard, but I'm doing what has to be done. And this is a classic reflection in Buddhism. It's difficult, it's challenging, but I'm doing what has to be done. This is good work. This is meaningful. Now, that's what's really important, what we're doing, not whether it's hard or not. Are we doing meaningful work? Are we doing good work? Are we practicing heartfully? Are we doing work that's coming from the heart? So we can take great joy in what we're doing, even though it may be hard. We can take great joy in what we're doing. So one modification, perhaps, in the perception of being a warrior. Be a happy warrior. Be a happy warrior. And that's a good mantra. You know, I'm a happy warrior. It's difficult, it's challenging, but I'm a happy warrior.